This is an LACTO Forum production.
Welcome to Exception Handlers, the podcast where CTOs debug the challenges that keep us up at night. I'm Alex.
And I'm Bill.
And in today's episode, we want to do something a little bit different and just have a conversation about stuff like we used to before all the interviews we've been doing lately. And the topic we want to look at is looking at various engineering practices that we all know and love and understanding and examining how AI impacts them. I think this is a timely conversation to have, no?
I think we're approaching the eye of the storm at the moment, and I think that there's a lot of ways this can go. It's going to be exciting.
Yes. So the three things we want to look at closer are clean code, test-driven development, or TDD, and refactoring. And the way we want to have this conversation is we want to understand why these practices exist in the first place. What specific problems are they trying to solve? And then how do we think AI impacts those practices? And hopefully in that conversation, we can have a better understanding of whether they still apply, they need to be modified somehow, they're no longer relevant at all, just to kind of have some mental model for how to think about it. And, you know, I know we've said this before, but we are living through the age of first principles here. So everything you think is a good idea, I think with AI, you have to really rethink and understand why you're doing it and whether it still applies. So all that said...
100% true. I think that we're looking at a situation here where the proportionality of different levels of effort is changing dramatically because the tool itself allows us to do things that we could never do before, at least at these speeds. And on the other hand, is not able to do things that we can do easily.
Yeah, absolutely. So with that, let's start. So let's first look at clean code. So I want to kind of lay out the definition of what that is and lay out some of the reasons why it exists in the first place. So definitionally, code is meant to be written primarily to be read by human beings, not just executed by machines. So what that means is when you're writing code, the clean code principles, and you know, these are like Uncle Bob Martin principles that he popularized in his book, Clean Code, but many, many practitioners have been doing this for years and years and years. All these ideas of you wanna express intent clearly, you wanna have no surprising side effects, consistent formatting, self-documenting names, short functions, you know, single responsibility per function, no deep nesting, all of these things that are ultimately meant to have code that's nice and easy for a human being to read and understand. And if you think about why that exists in the first place, is the first reason, probably the main reason, is humans have an inherent limitation, which is how many concepts we can keep in our heads at a time, right? Our working memory is pretty tiny. And so pretty much every clean code idea, short functions, single responsibility, meaningful names, and so on and so forth, all are like working memory optimizations. The fewer things you have to track when you're looking at a piece of code in your head, the better chance you have to understand what is happening in that code. And then very much related to that, code is read vastly more, you know, many people think 10 times as many times as it's written. And so it makes sense if you're reading a bunch of stuff all the time and writing it rarely, when you do write it, take the time to write it cleanly so that your reading self has benefited tremendously from that effort. And I want to be clear, clean code is not a free thing that just kind of naturally happens. You need to sit there and actually make the effort to create clean code because, you know, the temptation is just to kind of vomit out a bunch of code onto a page in a single massive 1,000-line function. And to fight that temptation, you actually have to go and think about it and organize it and all that. So there's a cost to it, but that cost is potentially justified. And then the last kind of big reason why it exists is this idea that code is a communication vehicle, both across teams, but also across time. So your past self is talking to your future self about what is happening in the code. And to make your future self happier, your past self should take the effort to make the code as clean as possible.
Yes, and I would extend that a little bit in terms of the traditional way of doing things. That also meant some non-trivial amount of documentation that was ancillary to the code itself that helped describe what was going on for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, well, I mean, documentation is actually interesting, right? Because I think Uncle Bob Martin's famous for saying, like, no comments, make the function names and the variable names be the comments, because why write all this other stuff? They go out of stuff. But yes, absolutely. Correlated documentation, whether embedded or external, is a key part of across-time communication, for sure.
Or it was. And that's kind of the, one of the topics I think that we're diving into.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about that, right? So like now you have AI reading and writing code instead of you. Given that, how many of these constraints still apply? So for instance, human working memory is tiny, but AI working memory may not be that tiny. And so do you want to spend time writing clean code, or do you want your AI spend time writing clean code for your AI to read later because it has a limited working memory? I don't know.
Well, and that comes back to what model do you adhere to? And right now, I think we're starting to see two different camps. One camp is I let the AI go out and do the programming based upon my inputs, and then I review the programming. Mm-hmm. The other model is more vibe-like, which is I let the AI handle it, and as long as the outputs are what I'm looking for and the inputs are what I'm looking for, it does what I want it to do, therefore it's okay, and the internals don't matter.
So crucially, it's not that the working memory constraint that humans experience goes away if the human is still reading the code at some point.
Well, you know,
whether it's writing it during the writing or post-writing, if a human is going to look at that thing at some point, then that constraint still applies. But to your point, if the human is no longer reading the code and it's just kind of trusting the outputs, if you will, and vibe coding the particulars, then that constraint probably doesn't apply because AI itself does not care nearly as much about how complicated the code is that AI itself wrote.
And I think there's a subtle layer to this too is there's reading the code and there's checking the diffs. And I think that there's a natural pressure right now for the humans to check the diffs more than read the code end to end. So you may see, a set of functions and the AI is coming in and saying, here are the changes I made, et cetera. And that need to go in and say, okay, what did you change versus let me examine the entire scope of how this is being used, et cetera, is becoming more common because let's be honest, at the pace that people are now expected to code or attempting to code, it's impossible to go ahead and read the code base within the full context every single time there's a change.
This is a genuine question that I genuinely struggle with, which is how good can you be at reading diffs if you don't understand the larger code base?
That's the million-dollar question.
Seriously, like...
No, I think societal collapses will be the ultimate arbiter.
But I think it's to me, it's an interesting question because, like, I think the overwhelming temptation is to look at the diffs, sort of make your impression of what they're doing, and move on with it.
Exactly. Look at the tools, right?
Yeah.
What are you being given? For me, I work in VSC. Okay. When something changes, very quickly you get the diff to pop up. It's very clear. It's right there. You can scroll up and down. The diffs are highlighted. Here's where I made my changes. Here's where I did. And it's just saying, focus on this, focus on this. If you're doing coding, and a lot of people are completely in the console, it's even more difficult because now you're having to focus on, even more subtle indications that there's changes out there, but scrolling up and down becomes cumbersome at some point. It's not a natural way to read that code, at least for me.
But so maybe actually the point to make here is, so my general mental model is like, I think you can look at the diffs without completely grokking the larger like context, the function, the method, the class or whatever, and kind of make sense of it. But that heavily depends on the class. And this is kind of in the ironic way where clean code helps. If you have like, take two examples. You have one massive 1,000-line 10 levels ifs nested function that gets a modification on level 7 where another line of code is added versus you've got the same code but in a set of small isolated functions, each of which do one thing and one thing only, and one of them gets touched. In other words, one is clean code, the other one isn't. I think if you're just reading that stuff and only looking at the diffs and nothing else, you have a much better shot understanding what the hell just happened in that one modification. So, in other words, the reason to do clean code isn't that your working memory is constrained or whatever, or AI is writing stuff and you're no longer writing it. It's that it makes it easier for you to read the diffs, to grok the diffs, because you're not writing anything. You're not reading everything. You're only reading the diffs. But those divs are much more comprehensible if they're in a smaller context.
Yeah, and it also changes the I guess what I would call the scope of context for what you're thinking is important. Because on one hand, you would have to completely digest the seven nested ifs to understand what's going on there all at once. On the other hand, if you're just looking at it from the clean code function, you're assuming that function is being invoked at the right time under the right circumstances by a similar set of logic that is expressed in other ways.
And another related thing to that is side effects, right? So clean code's famously against side effects because they're hard to reason about. And again, right, if your change is sort of isolated and you know that generally it's written in a way that it does not have side effects, anything that's happening is happening visibly in front of your eyes, much easier to make sense of without grokking the entire system that it's running at the same time.
It is definitely... As with all things, I think we're going to come in these conversations, is it's a balance. And the question is it a balance that we're going to find the answer to, or is it a balance that's going to continuously be sliding?
Yeah. Well, and so I guess we talked about kind of the memory constraint and the sort of the read versus write ratio. So, and I think it sounds like we're both agreeing that even if AI is reading and writing the vast majority of the time, as long as the human is still in the loop, clean code is valuable. And then I think... probably would also agree that communication across time still makes a lot of sense, because
I think communication across time is gigantic, just from the standpoint of have you used AI yet to go back to some old code and just drop in with Claude and say, look, I haven't touched this thing in 4 years. I need to make a fix.
And to that point, I think at some point you're going to look at some code and it hopefully is under reasonable stress-free circumstances.
The server is down.
Much more likely that it's not going to be. And if you do have to look at actual code, it better be as grokkable as possible.
Yeah, no, I agree. So the only caveat I would say about the communication across time is it's not as granular as the context of when, you know, right now when we're writing stuff, the level of understanding, quote unquote, by the AI while you're doing the coding is much greater than it is when it does the reintroduction of code through a read, which is why I will say that humans do a much better job at spanning what I would call compact events, because it's a single conversation and we're good at that. Whereas once it gets beyond a certain level of information, to your point, you can't process it all. Whereas the AI can continue to read larger and larger amounts of data and suck it in and understand what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, we do not have a 1 million token context in our brains. That's for
I'm
sure.
I think I'm at about 150 at the moment.
Yeah, it's in the low teens for me. So, the way to kind of wrap this up and move on to the next one is I want to kind of look at it from a perspective of clean code is not free. It takes effort and energy and an investment to create and maintain. And it used to be the case that it was a good idea because the humans were in the loop. Now I think it's still a good idea, even though AI is in the loop. And it's worth the ongoing investment of time, tokens, and so forth. It is no longer kind of it's still a relevant relevant practice.
I agree. And I think that that's from this point of, even though the machines can go ahead and reread this in the future, if someone else has to look at this thing and decide whether or not the change that is made in that particular emergency situation or large undertaking, that they can also come up to speed as well as the machine. Otherwise, you're going into the first person to use it is working as a co-author with AI, and the second person is working as a chimp, and that's not going to work. Well, it's true. I mean, if you go into 100% vibe code and then you have to understand how the code works just to fix it for me, I mean, you are.
Well, I mean, at that point, all your eggs are in one AI basket, and if you've got a problem there, you're done.
You have just as good a chance of turning the thing into an omelet as you do working software.
Great. So that was clean code. Now let's talk about refactoring. And just again, definitionally, what is refactoring? Refactoring is restructuring existing code without changing its external behavior. So you're trying to improve how the code is structured and organized, but while keeping the functionality identical. And so crucially, you're not adding features, you're not fixing bugs, you're not rewriting anything. You're simply modifying the internals. And you know, common forms of this: extracting functions and classes, renaming stuff, removing duplications, simplifying conditionals, restructuring internal data objects, things like this. So kind of the canonical metaphor that people talk about here is paying down technical debt, right? So You're not spending anymore. You're paying down the stuff that you've already spent. And if you look at first principles of why this is a good idea, and obviously many people think it's a good idea to do refactoring on a regular basis, is first and foremost, entropy, right? So code naturally degrades over time as features are added, requirements change, shortcuts are taken and all that. And refactoring is kind of the counterbalance, the counterforce. Without it, code bases just tend to move towards one big ball of mud direction. And then why that is important is the cost of change gets higher and higher, right, as your code gets worse and worse. And of course, like, I think if you ask any CTO, right, the thing that's kind of drilled into all of our heads is our job fundamentally is to keep the cost of change as flat as possible over the life of the, you know, software, which...
And as close to zero as possible, if you're talking to the CFO.
Exactly. Well, close. Zero is... that would be incredible, but at least flat. So if a change made today costs you roughly the same as it did 2 years ago, you're in pretty good shape. If it's five times as much, that's bad. And if you don't proactively manage the code base, that's what tends to happen, right? So people are like, if you don't refactor on an ongoing basis, you're going to pay the price at some point by just taking forever to build anything on that, on top of that code base.
Yeah, and this ties in perfectly with the conversation we just had about the communication across time, A, and B, ostensibly handing off the work to another person who wasn't the original author.
Which is one of the big reasons why the code becomes harder and more expensive to change. Whatever that you had in your head that was kind of filling in the understanding gaps isn't there when the next guy shows up 2 years later. And even if the code base is sort of manageable for you, that does not mean it's manageable for somebody else. Well,
I mean, have you ever saw anyone or talked to anyone who's an engineer who said, yeah, I like dealing with other people's code?
Yeah, it's so funny. When I first started in software engineering, I didn't really appreciate how strong the impulse is to rewrite everything because you hate looking at other people's code. Because up until that point, it was just me doing stuff in college and I never had to deal with that at all.
As a group of people, we still argue over two spaces, four spaces, or tabs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it is funny, but it is true. I mean, people hate reading or managing other people's code because it didn't come out of them. It didn't come out
of
their
head. Well, it's also, it used to be completely deterministic. There's a style to it. It's just like the English language. You could tell, you could do Goldilocks a lot of different ways and have the exact same story come out. It's just told in many different ways. And there's some that resonate with you and there's some that don't.
That's exactly right. That's the crux of it, right? It the story could be fine and it could resonate great with you, but not with your neighbor. The words they're hearing are not connecting in their brain the way they're connecting in yours.
Yeah, and we all have our favorite little functions or methods or ways of doing things or libraries or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Well,
so the other thing about this that I think is really important to note as far as why this pattern exists is it's true that understanding of the domain is usually progressive. In other words, when you first start building stuff, you almost certainly never fully understand the domain, the concepts, the business problem, and the requirements.
100%.
And so as you go on and your understanding evolves, refactoring is almost a way to kind of imbue the code base with that improved understanding because you could now detect patterns that emerge in the code and make them explicit. You can now detect, the old adage of like, if you see something once, do it. If you see the same thing again, write it again. And if you see it for the third time, look for an abstraction and then start abstracting away. So refactoring is also useful because it kind of makes explicit learning that happens over the lifetime of the code base.
Yes, it effectively, to paraphrase that, it instantiates your learning of the system.
Yes, exactly. And then lastly, and this is more about sort of the mechanics of this, refactoring is almost certainly done in small incremental steps. It's like a kind of a industry, joke, like the big sky, pie in the sky refactors are usually a terrible idea, meaning those are not really refactors, they're just rewrites, and they're almost certainly a bad idea. If you're doing refactoring, you're almost definitionally doing it in small digestible steps?
Well, that's a great question to see how long that ideology lasts, right? Now in the age of AI, why don't we just throw it into the bot and let it sit there and churn out a few million lines of code in the way it should be?
Well, frankly, I think this is probably, in fact, this is a great place to now start looking at those first principles and thinking about how AI impacts them. And yes, definitely. But even before that, like the entropy question. So if AI can regenerate a code base or a clean implementation on demand, why bother fighting entropy? So like, in other words, the classical approach is you write something, and then over the course of months, as you learn more, as you see patterns emerge, you incrementally, slowly but surely, clean them up, refactor, reorganize, so that 6 months later, you have a up-to-date, more featured, but also cleaner code base, right? Versus, you don't bother with any of that over the course of 6 months, and then in 6 months, you say, or in 1 month, or in whatever months, you say, hey, Claude, take a look at this code base. It's doing all the right stuff, but it's kind of a mess now. Give me a clean implementation. And suddenly, you know, problem solved.
Yeah, I think that there are situations where that could largely work, particularly if it's the person who authored the original. The place where I could see it having issues is many times, speaking of tech debt, there are little hacks that have to be added here or there. They're distasteful, but they were put in under stressful situations. And they may not make sense logically when you step back, because you would have never built it that way had you known about that issue up front. And one of the things that I've noticed about the models is they come in and they're generally pretty good about, you know, following whatever architectural references they're using, et cetera. And they'll run into skips like that. And they'll, if they don't ask a question about it, they'll quote unquote help you fix it by just smoothing it over, because you should have never done it that way in the first place, without addressing the core issue that was being solved, albeit incorrectly.
Well, I think so. This actually goes. So let me say one thing about what you just said, which I completely agree with, which is that, so like fundamentally, refactoring assumes that improving existing code is cheaper than just replacing it, which has definitely been true up until AI showed up. And I think it's still true, but to your point, contextually, it really depends on what we're talking about. But I think the other thing that's very much related to this is, you know, there's also this very old idea of, to do refactoring safely, you have to have a corresponding set of tests that are catching potential problems that you might introduce as you're doing your refactoring. And that safety net of tests, if you don't have that, then AI could call, like, to your point, you might have some weird sort of jagged edges in your code base, but as long as there's tests validating that behavior and making sure that it still exists, you could still have AI do your refactoring kind of in one shot. And if it forgets it, you will have the red flag of a test that just failed that says, hey, this used to do something, it no longer does.
At the unit test level, I will agree. Well, if it has something that has...
I mean, whichever level you want, right? Unit, integration, function. I mean, yes, sure. Like, some stuff is very subtle to be caught with.
Well, it's subtle and it can span systems. So the localized testing could be very difficult. So I just think there are some cases where the AI is going to, and if you're not paying attention to our earliest points, the AI is going to do something that if you don't catch it, will cause a problem that may not show up until you repeat that error.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And also a lot of it also depends on, like, you know, exactly how long are you waiting, right? Are you maybe waiting 2 years to do your big rewrite with AI is a terrible idea, but maybe doing it like once every 2 months.
Well, and the other thing to be fair is if the application started out being written by AI and was patched over time by AI, and you decide you want to refactor it with AI to the point of being able to span time and relearn what was going on, AI does a phenomenal job of capturing what you've done. So a lot of that context can be pulled forward, even if that there was a hack.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So let's talk for a second about the cost of change idea, right? So again, you refactor so that the cost of change is flat. It costs you about the same today as it did 2 years ago to make a change. And here, I think it's actually an interesting conversation. Is AI... Does AI impact this in any way? You could, for example, make the argument that AI has like less tolerance for a big ball of mud than a human expert does because it doesn't have the context, unless somehow that context was also created by AI, to your point, if it's an AI created code base. But if it's some legacy system that is complicated and, you know, big ball of mud, and you have a person who understands some aspects of that that aren't written down anywhere, I would argue that it's probably AI is worse at trying to make changes to that thing than a human would. So it does make sense to keep refactoring.
No, I agree with that. Now, one of the places where I think AI could be helpful is going in and examining the bowl of mud to see if there's ways to turn it into spoonfuls of dirt. But I think that yeah, absolutely, there's still a case for that.
Yeah, definitely. And then, you know, the other stuff like progressive understanding. That, you know, that I think that's whether AI is doing that or not. I think that's still the case that your understanding evolves over time. And whether you want to kind of continue encoding that understanding into the code base, I don't think AI really changes that. I think it's still true.
I don't either. And I to be honest, as things progress, I think for me, the one thing that isn't changing is that the value of humans in this whole process is the larger context.
Right. Right. And I guess, you know, the other sort of operational thing of incrementalism and making it happen in small steps. I mean, it's debatable whether you still need to do it in very small steps or larger steps are okay because AI can kind of handle more. But clearly, there's still some need for incrementalism here because you don't want to wait for a lot of stuff to be in place before rewriting all of it in one shot.
Well, and the other thing too is that I think pretty much, at least with today's AI, there's still a huge value in keeping it focused on each task as you go along because it tends to be more thorough in that case.
Yeah. You know, the other thing I think that's interesting to talk about here is just logistics of this. So, for example, Claude has the simplifier skill. I think it's called Code Simplifier or something like that, where it basically kind of after finishing some change that it made for you, you can run the simplifier and it'll essentially refactor whatever it is you just did. Basically, right? Because that's what it's almost literally what it's trying to do. It's trying to simplify the implementation, remove ambiguity, remove duplication, all of that. In my mind, that is refactoring. So like if your agentic engineering workflow is do the thing and then run the simplifier agent or whatever, that's basically ongoing refactoring. That's what you're doing.
Yeah. To your earlier point, though, talk about a place where you need tests.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we'll talk about TDD next, but my God, like testing is so crucial to all of this, no matter who is doing it.
Yes, I think it's a huge element when you're synthesizing things, but it is an astronomically large element when you're trying to, quote, simplify things, because AI is really good about making gigantic assumptions.
It's not shy about making serious code changes. Yeah. It doesn't have that human, maybe I shouldn't do this. I could get fired over this. It doesn't have any of that.
You told me to make it smaller. It says, hello world.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, so maybe this is a good time to move to TDD because I feel like, you know, that's another really interesting thing to think about just in terms of how AI impacts it, but also because testing is such a vital component of all the rest of the stuff we've just talked about. So TDD, test-driven development. What is that? First, just definitionally, it is the idea that you write a failing test before you implement any functioning code. Then you write the minimum code to pass the test, and you keep going like this until you're done. So the red-green refactor cycle, right? You write a test, it's green, it's red initially, it fails. Then you write some minimal code to get it to pass. It passes, and now you go back and say, did this thing that I just write, could that be done better? Can I refactor it as I go so that the system's sort of coherent and sensible? You know, this was a big, big thing with the XP crowd, right? Extreme programming, Ken Beck was a big proponent of this. And yeah, like, you know, why does it exist? Why TDD? So first and foremost, and this is an interesting, I've always found this very interesting as far as like the design feedback premise. So if you write your test first, you are forced to write the interface before the internals. And if you are doing that and it's hard to test it, that's a signal to you that you designed a poor interface and you should redesign it. Because the tests at that point, a test suite is almost like a side effect that comes out of that. The point isn't to write tests. The point is to drive good design. And it just so happens you do that with testing. I've always found that very interesting.
Well, and the other thing too is, as the resident pessimist, it's a great place to say what could go wrong.
Right, right. Actually very much related to the other big reason, and not just specifically TDD, just obviously any testing, but TDD especially, you have this confidence to change stuff, right? Because you have this presumably comprehensive test suite that validates all the behaviors that should be there. And so you're not thinking, ooh, if I touch this, well, what will blow up? You're like, I will get in there and I will just start ripping stuff out and replacing stuff. And if something goes bad, the test will fail. And I feel good about that.
Yep. No, I think that's, again, I think from the perspective, what could go wrong is the way to build a lot of these things, because most of us think about what it should be doing as opposed to what it might be doing.
Yeah. Well, you know, developers are notoriously bad at thinking about SAT paths in their code base. They're optimists by nature, I guess. They just don't think about something to go bad.
Let's be honest. Through most organizations, everybody's rewarded through functionality, right? And sadly, in the engineering world, you're unrewarded for dysfunctionality, but people tend to do what they're rewarded for.
Truly, truly. The other thing, as far as like TDD and why it exists, it's an interesting cognitive forcing function, because it forces you, and this is kind of back to the design feedback idea, it forces you to explain what the code should do before how it should do it. Because like, if you write a test first, you have to name that test. And naming of that test is describing the behavior that's intended to be implemented in the system. So you're having to first write down what this thing should be doing. And then once you have the test, then you can go and implement it, i.e. translate that into how it should be done. And this is interesting and important, because like, if you didn't do this, then what could happen is you would kind of write whatever you're going to write, whatever functionality you're going to write, whatever code you're going to write that does stuff. And it may not be an optimal way of doing it, but because you wrote the test, the code first, you write tests almost as a rationalization of the code. And those tests could look stupid. They could be missing important things. They could be awkward. But because you already made the mental commitment to the code, you're just kind of writing tests after the fact. And, you know, there's no forcing function to make sure that the code that's actually in the system is clean and well designed. Because,
well, and yes, and to that exact point, one of the things I've noticed about with any of the models I've worked with, if you can point it at the tests or desired outcome versus non-desired outcome, it is incredibly more explicit in what it does and much more thorough about how it does it.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And so one more thing I want to say about why TDD exists. It's kind of a therapist for human beings, because it like gives you these small verifiable wins as you go, which makes you feel good and takes away the anxiety of coding. Because like, and I'm sure, I mean, I assume you've experienced this, but I certainly have. When I used to sit down for like, and like know that I have to write a whole bunch of stuff, it's really anxiety inducing, because you're like, where do I even begin here? There is so much that needs to kind of come into existence and I don't have a place to start. With TDD, the place to start is write the first test that will fail. And it's very mechanical and it's very sort of, you know, kind of obvious. It's not complicated. And then you write the bare minimum code that passes it, and suddenly you see this red-green cycle kick in. You're like, oh, this is great. I feel so good about this now. And I just keep going. And it really is like a little therapist that's sitting next to you saying, you're good, man. Things are good. You're going.
Okay. I've got your Christmas present picked out. You're going to get my test passed as a t-shirt.
But seriously, I think there's a lot to be said for this reduction of anxiety through small wins is a big psychological impact on engineers.
Well, and I think this is also another perfect place to talk about where humans, I think, will remain very, very valuable. And that is being in charge of the tests themselves. Mm-hmm. Because the machines can certainly write tests, but in my experience, and maybe I'm not good at having machines write tests, they write tests that are sometimes really dumb. I mean, yeah, it's a test, but you're not testing anything that has to do with what the context of what this is supposed to be doing or where it may go wrong. You're testing it in terms of, yeah, it's a string. Oh, great. Okay. Yes. Thank you. You output a string. Fantastic. Or it's not a string. When you have the humans do it, in addition to the psychological joy it brings some of us, it also allows you to be very thorough and specific in the larger context, coming back to my earlier point, whereas the human knows what this is supposed to be doing in the world, okay? The bot is really good at what this does in the code base. And by being able to write these tests, you're bringing your perspective from the world into the code base.
So that's really interesting. And I actually think this is a great transition too. Let's talk about how does AI impact the practice of TDD? Because I think what you just said is super relevant to that. And I also want to just prefix it with, again, we're talking about AI is doing the writing, right? So AI is writing the test and the code. And so I think the first place to kind of talk about that is like, you know, design feedback, right? So again, the idea here is you write a test and then you write the code that passes it, then you refactor. And that's supposed to kind of drive out good design. Does that still apply here? If AI is doing all that?
Well, I would say, based on my previous conversation, as long as the human is directing how and what the tests are, I think that yes. So but if it's, hey, Mr. Bot, go out and please write the tests for these, for this thing that's supposed to do this at a higher level, I think you're still going to end up with tests that don't have the coverage that you need. And I think that part of that is because it won't have the context that you have.
Well, this is really like, and this is where I think in kind of the struggle in my mind is like, so logistically, what does this look like, right? So I wonder if you could just say, hey, Claude, I want you to write code that does blah, blah, blah. But the way I want you to do it is I want you to first tell me what tests you will create that will validate the behavior. And then it says, I'm going to create blah, 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 and blah, and blah. And then you go, you look all that and you go, oh, that's fine. But I think this should be done. This test should be looking for this behavior. This test doesn't even make sense anymore. And you forgot these three. And you just have that conversation with it.
A, yes, that's very legitimate. Or B, you could go right up front, you know, Claude, I want you to build this function. It's going to do this. We also need to build tests that make sure we test for this, this, and this, and tests that we make sure that we do not see that, that, or that.
And so crucially in that flow, because we're talking TDD here, remember, are you asking Claude to write the tests first and then write the code that passes him? And are you also telling it to do the TDD thing of make the test pass with the least amount of code possible and then keep going until all the tests pass?
Well, I think,
like, do you see what I mean? How far do you push this?
Well, in today's world, and it's June 2nd, 2026, you could have a skill that basically says if there aren't significant levels of tests, call it out and discuss, or make sure that you always apply these behaviors to the tests that have been defined up front.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I am not convinced that the sequence of events ultimately matters if AI is doing both. In other words, I'm not convinced that if you say to Claude, on one hand, here's the functionality I want, and here are the tests I want, and I want you to write the tests before the code, or I don't care what sequence you write them in, as long as at the end of it, I have a test suite that validates these things and the code exists that does these things and I can run it and I can see it. I am not sure that it actually matters.
I don't think so either.
Practically speaking. So like this is that's what I'm saying. Like the TDD part of that, test-driven development, test first.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not sure that applies if AI is doing both of them.
Well, okay. Things. Yeah, although if the quote original authoring of the code isn't done until the tests have all been completed, is it just has TDD been thrown away or has it been modified to the AI world?
Well, this is, to me, it's interesting. Like, I think TDD is the trickiest best practice to really apply to AI because, like, It's obvious to me still that clean code makes sense, refactoring makes sense. Whether AI is writing the code or not doesn't matter. It still makes sense. TDD, the sequence of events, because I almost feel like, how would you know what got written first? I mean, I know you could actually literally see the test showing up before the code, but like, you know, what do you know about the internals of the model and what it's thinking it's doing, right? Like, it might be writing code in memory and then writing tests in memory and just happens to write the test out to files first because you don't know what's happening in its neural network.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? Like there,
it's no. Yeah, I totally get that. I'm thinking it from the perspective though of when I have been able to give it very precise input and outputs and thou shalt nots before it writes the code, mm-hmm. it tends to get it right the first time much more often because I believe what it's doing is going in there and it's scrolling by so fast you can't keep up with it anymore, but I believe what it's doing is it's writing something and it's quickly running the test because I see it kicking off Python all the time, trying different things. And then it comes back and says, yeah, I think I've got it. And in that sense, I haven't come across the situation where it says, yeah, I got it. And the things I told it had to pass were not true.
Okay. So, all right. So what you're saying is having AI do TDD does seem to have a positive impact on, you know, the efficiency and arguably probably the design of the code base as well, because presumably it got the right thing done in the first place.
To that extent, I can't comment because I haven't done any studies on it whatsoever. Sure. But in terms of efficiency, getting it right the first time, it certainly has. The other thing too, I mean, to be honest, from a human discipline standpoint, if you force yourself to go down that pathway, you have a much better chance of having tests when the thing is done, as opposed to there's times when I've just ran in there and coded stuff. And it's like, yep, I'll see if it breaks when I fire the system up.
I think that's a fantastic point. And it's interesting, right? So TDD was initially kind of created in part to have a forcing function for forcing you to think about, you know, what the code should do before how it should do it. Maybe the new forcing function is just getting to write some tests.
We've gone from throwing stuff over the wall to QA to putting it in the trebuchet.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing I'll say about this, you know, the thing we said earlier in terms of like anxiety reduction, I mean, that clearly does not apply. I don't think AI cares one bit about, oh my God, I'm not accomplishing anything until I start writing some tests.
Yeah, I think we can rule out anxiety on the bot side.
Yeah. So I guess to kind of wrap this up, it seems like maybe TDD is still relevant, although for possibly different reasons than before.
Yeah, I think so. I think, again, I for the most part, I think it's an efficiency play, which you can certainly be successful without it, but the ability for it to help the human ensure that you have the tests in place for future use, I think is really important.
Well, I think the other thing related to that is TDD or not TDD, it's critical. It's clearly obvious that testing is critical in this new world of AI, more so, I would even say, than before. Just because there's so much more code that's getting created. So however the tests come into existence, as CTOs, you almost have an obligation to, not almost, you have an obligation to demand it, absolutely demand it from your agentic engineering developers.
Yeah, and I think as the world starts to move towards at least pre-review of PRs, things like checking for tests and things like that before it's even considered will start to force that as well. And that might ultimately be the way that it's enforced. But I foresee other mechanisms by which tests, to your point, covering the vast increase in lines of code will become a mandatory step.
Yeah. Wow. This has been quite the conversation. We've covered some... I think really interesting topics here with clean code, refactoring, and TDD. But perhaps we're at a natural stopping point.
Or an unnatural stopping point, which is kind of okay in the world of AI these days.
Yeah, no, I think we're coming in for a pretty soft landing here. Well, if you found the topics covered in this conversation relevant or interesting to you, LA CTO Forum has lots of opportunities to engage with other CTOs on topics just like this one. If you're interested in learning more, find us on LinkedIn or on the web at lactoforum.org. And until next time, may your deployments be smooth and your tech debt manageable.
And remember, if you can't handle the exception, at least log it properly. We'll catch you next time.